Today on Pilgrim Radio's His People, Sam Eaton on pursuing God's gift of life with reckless delight.
But I think our faith starts to get a little bit same, and I think our mental health even sometimes starts to feel a little monotonous if we're not taking some of those bold risks and those courageous steps that I think God calls us to.
Sam Eaton next. Today, Sam Eaton is an author and public speaker, and he shares a message of hope. It was in a time of crisis that he made the decision to chase a life that is fully and recklessly alive. Spencer Dahlke talks now with Sam Eaton, author of the book Recklessly Alive, What My Suicide Attempt Taught Me About God and Living Life to the Fullest.
By way of introduction, would you tell us a little bit about yourself and why you wrote this book?
I started my career as a public school music teacher. And while I was teaching, I saw just the huge need that our youth and young adults have around mental health. And then in that same time, we actually lost two students, a teacher and a principal, who all took their own life in a short amount of time. And so in that moment, I just felt a really push in my chest from God, like I needed to do something to help. And the more I researched it, I realized how much it was happening, not just in my home community, but everywhere. So I've spent the last 10 years doing my part, trying to tell my story, my journey with mental health, and then provide people with resources, education, inspiration, anything that I can do to just help them have a little easier path than I had it. And so I'm doing that in a bunch of different ways. I have three books out, including this new one that is a daily journal, that's our daily journey that's meant to feel like a friend sitting with you each morning, just saying, hey, you can do this. Here are some things that I've learned. I've got you and you can do it.
Mental health seems to be the prevailing, I guess, discussion in public discourse, shall we say. We talk a lot about it. I understand you've had quite the tumultuous story yourself, and yet you've come away thinking that you want to live recklessly alive. So what does recklessly alive mean to you, and how does that connect with your own experiences, and lay that groundwork for us?
So I grew up with an alcoholic father, and as a result of that disease, he just caused a lot of pain in my life. But it created in me a person who was really afraid of the world and afraid to live. It was my kindergarten teacher recommended to my mom that they hold me back for a year because I would hide under the tables. I could read. She was like, he can read. Like, why would we hold him back? But just socially, I would just hide under the table at school. That's a metaphor for kind of how I felt about life through my teenage years, even into my 20s. There were a lot of challenges against me. I had a lot of adversity, but I also wasn't doing myself any favors. I wasn't really seeking help. I wasn't living the life that I wanted to. And so I was kind of stuck in what felt like a prison. I was stuck at home, isolating, not doing the things that I wanted to do, too afraid to do the things that I wanted to do. So the recklessly alive phrase just came out of actually my first book when I was sitting down to write the introduction. It's actually the story of me going skydiving for the first time about 3 years after my attempt. So now you've got this kid who's like terrified to live, and I'm like jumping out of an airplane, and our first parachute didn't open actually. So we had to like pull our backup parachute. And so it does not necessarily mean jumping out of an airplane, but I think it just means living a life that you like, that you enjoy, that you're proud of, and making choices that make you feel more alive. To me, the core of the gospel is when, you know, Jesus came so that we could have life and have it to the fullest. And I think that's going to be different for everyone. But for me, it meant pushing myself out into the world, making some big dreams, going for them, taking risks, and learning what makes me enjoy being alive. Because for a lot of my life, I just haven't felt that way, unfortunately.
I guess looking a little bit at this the public discourse surrounding mental health, you've mentioned you've been working, you know, to understand mental health and to coach and to help people, you know, understand how to live well. What are we not talking about when it comes to mental health?
How much time do you have? First and foremost, it's just that like everyone has mental health. We love to talk about taking care of our physical health, nutrition, exercise, all of that. In fact, we're kind of obsessed with it. But everybody, whether they struggle with mental illness like I have or not, has mental health to care for. And there's things that you can do for that. We know about 1 in 5 people will struggle with mental illness at some point in their life. And on average, it's about 8 to 10 years from the time someone starts experiencing those negative symptoms to the time I get help? And that was my story. There's noticeable changes in me at 14. It wasn't till well into my 20s that I sought help. And so a part of the biggest discussion, especially in the church world, at least in my experience, when I started opening up about my mental health, it was always met immediately as a spiritual thing. Like, you need to read more, pray more. And I had all this guilt that I wasn't doing faith right, because no matter how many Bible studies I went to, no matter how many times I volunteered on the worship team or led youth group trips, I still had these thoughts in my head. I still had mental health that was not in the best spot. And what I needed someone in those moments were to also tell me, hey, there's a very medical side to mental health as well. You know, they've done brain scans of depressed and suicidal brains, and part of your brain doesn't light up the way that it should. And I do believe that God can and will heal us in an instant. I believe he's still capable of that. And sometimes he doesn't. And so for a while, I was mad at Christians in the church that their answer was faith, that their answer was read the Bible more. Now, in my old wise age, that's the tool that they have. That's what they know. They're offering you, especially if they haven't struggled with it themselves, faith is what has helped them. And that is a good tool to have in our toolbox. And I think it's really important that we talk about this like we would the flu or like we would cancer. And so our advice should be similar, because just like mental health, it can be very deadly. We lose almost 50,000 people a year in the US who take their own life. It's the second leading cause of death for young people ages 10 to 24. 10 is about fourth or fifth grade. These are really important discussions to have. And as we talk about them, I want us to talk more about more of our advice to sound like you'd say to someone who has something physically wrong with them, because that's what our advice should sound like.
It almost sounds like the church especially has a framework to understand. I mean, God gives us bodies. That's part of who we are as humanity, you know? So, you know, it's good to consider how the body affects the soul as much as the soul affects the body.
And the church can be one of the best places for our mental health, especially for youth. It teaches stories about struggle. It provides built-in community. It's a place you can go every week. It's repeatable. You don't have to achieve anything. So I absolutely believe that that is a great place for people. It can be a great place for people who are struggling with their mental health. And also, let's make sure that our churches are equipped with resources of local therapists or, you know, other local mental health resources that they can seek out if they do open up and they do share that they might need something a little bit more than just Sundays at church.
You've mentioned the vulnerable demographic to depression and stuff is, you said something like ages 10 to 24, which I can't help but observe. That's just kind of like usually about the age that, you know, men and women go through puberty. How much of this demographic is merely being affected by hormone imbalances versus legitimate mental health problems?
We do know that about 20% of them are diagnosable. I mean, that 1 in 5, as we look around, those numbers are pretty high. I do think also we've really struggled to keep up with the way that the world has changed. It's pretty easy to point to social media as a struggle, but the Surgeon General said that anything over 3 hours a day on social media doubles your risk for depression and anxiety. And the average teenager is spending 3.5 hours a day. So just average. And we know there's many who are on that a lot more. And so these social media companies have spent billions of dollars making these things as addictive as possible. I was lucky that social media didn't come out till I was a senior in high school. I just missed the wave. But like when I was a kid, if you were being bullied at school, at least at 3 o'clock, you got to go home and you had a peaceful night. No one could find you. Your bully's not coming into your house. And now that our kids have these devices, it is 24/7. They can find them at all times. They can create fake accounts. It is a big deal. I know we're hearing and talking about it everywhere. But those are tangible things that we can do that we know it's at least not helping. So let's start looking at the things in our young people's lives that we know aren't helping and start to pull those back and start to teach them how to use them responsibly, because they have been designed to be addictive. And then we expect a teenager at a time in their development when they do not have a lot of impulse control to be able to regulate this, right? It's like handing a kid a pack of cigarettes and being like, yeah, definitely don't smoke. It's bad for you. But that is the level of seriousness that some of this is. And as I look through, yes, we are more aware now, but that has been, I think, the biggest change for sure that our young people are facing or maybe don't have the tools. I even myself don't always have the tools to deal with how tricky those algorithms are.
Looking at your book a little bit, you're kind of connecting some of these things that you've been thinking about clearly, and you write a number of affirmations you say daily that we can read, presumably to help with our mental health a little bit. Can you tell us a little bit about the purpose of the book and what you're hoping the effect of reading these affirmations would be?
So the book is designed where each day, it's designed a bit like a devotional. We actually kept it religiously neutral so that it could help anyone. We wanted to be able to reach as many people as possible. I've heard as I've traveled the country, a lot of parents, grandparents, aunts and uncles, they want to help. They can see a young person in their life that's struggling and they don't know what to do. And so this book is designed to be a gift of connection, just a gift of, hey, I'm here for you. Maybe it's a graduation gift or something like that. But it's a moment each day that this young person or any age, but can have an encouraging person who's been there, who's going to say, hey, here are some things I've faced. Here's how I've got through it. And here are the skills that have helped me. So each of the 7 days has a theme to a skill that I've needed. The first day is bold action. Like we talked about this at the beginning. I was so afraid to go after the things I wanted. And sometimes in life, we just have to go for it. We have to take that risk. We can't be so afraid. I talk about self-talk, and that's where the affirmations come in. The way you talk to yourself, what your brain sounds like, we want that to sound like an encouraging friend. And for a lot of us, that inner voice is very mean, aggressive. You know, one translation for the devil or the enemy is the accuser. And sometimes that's what the voices in my head sound like. And so there are actually little tips that you can do and learn how to change that voice overnight. Affirmations are one of them. If you kind of combat those negative thoughts, some of the other themes are self-worth, those things that we learn, hopefully in church and in the Bible, that we were made on purpose for a purpose, that God knew us before we were in the womb. Resilience, what happens when life doesn't go our way? Because that's going to happen to everybody. How do we pick ourselves back up? What are the things we tell ourselves to get us through those hard moments? Self-care, the way we just put space in our week, right? God told us to rest on the seventh day for a reason. And we're like, most of us are like, no, we're good. Like, no, we're fine. We don't need to rest. You know, maybe if God told us we should rest more, maybe we should. So finding ways to fit that into our life, and then connection and purpose. So just, unfortunately, we need people. I keep trying to tell God that, like, I don't need anyone. And he's like, no, actually, actually, Sam, you do. And I think a lot of people struggle with that as well. So what was my journey of finding better community, finding people, putting myself out there, trying to find my way back? So the book is not about suicide. It's nothing heavy like that. It's meant to help anyone who just feels stuck, who wants to feel a little bit more alive. But also it comes with that understanding. And I allude to dark seasons that I've had struggles with, but we kept it approachable for everyone.
Well, my guest today is Sam Eaton. He's the founder of the Recklessly Alive Foundation and author of You Can Do This, Daily Affirmations to Live Recklessly Alive. I see what you're describing in your book, something very much like what we might read in the Psalms, where often the psalmist is combating, you know, not just dark thoughts, but discouraging thoughts and moments of doubt by talking back to our soul and saying, my soul, why are you cast down? Hope in God. So,
absolutely right. Like we hear verses like take every thought captive and make, you know, focus our thoughts on beautiful things. But how do we do that? What does that actually look like in practice? And that's taken a long time for me to learn. And so I share a lot of that in the book too.
Looking at one of these things, I had a thought, and I'd love your thoughts about this. The first one, right from the beginning, you mentioned bold action, you know, taking action to go do things that you want to do. I've noticed that in our, you know, society structures, you know, we have, you know, government, community structure, and different things like this. It just seems like there's a lot of no. No, you can't climb trees. In the park pretty close by here, all the like lower branches are like lopped off because we're, you know, liability or whatever. And it just seems like a lot of these good things we're told, no, we can't do these. Do you think there's a connection to poor mental health when we're just denying good and activities and to our young people?
I think there's a lot of room in this world to make excuses to not go after the things that we want. And I did that, right? We said, well, they said I can't climb a tree. Well, there's 2 million other things that you could do that would make you feel more alive. And so we need to push through those boundaries that are around us. I mean, for me, I'm a bit of a rule follower, as long as I understand that the rule makes sense and is there for a reason. If it genuinely is keeping people safe, like, yeah, I can go to the forest and climb a different tree. But I do think we're all going to face times where that door closes, where someone says no. And you know, one of my little phrases is, when someone says no, make your own yes. Like, if this door closes, like, it took me 7 years to get my first book published. I was trying to work with different publishers. I got picked up, I got dropped. A different version of myself would have just given up and would have just said, oh, I guess this isn't meant to be. There's too many no's. And so I do think there, it takes some wisdom to step back and look and be like, actually, no, this rule isn't helping me. And I'm going to take that step and live the in a way that's best for me and for my community and try to help people. So I don't know how much it's affecting our youth, but I do think we should encourage them to get outside, live their life to the best that they can.
You have so many, you know, chapters, affirmations that you mentioned, and, you know, little devotionals that you've written about, obviously, like you've mentioned, the theme very clearly seems to be like living life and you know, sucking the marrow out of life, shall we say. Are there some of these that you think Christians don't latch on to or don't understand that we should?
I think it is really easy to get stuck in the motions of doing church and doing Christianity and then feeling unfulfilled. At least that was my story. I was volunteering at church 4 and 5 days a week. I was going to Bible study. I was A+ student of church, and I was missing out on some of the adventure of following and loving God. Some of the part of my soul that wants to go and do and try. So actually 18 months after my suicide attempt, I spent 6 weeks as a missionary in Zimbabwe. I auditioned for this music ministry. I was terrified. I didn't like singing in public. I did it despite being scared because something in my soul was like, I want to try this. And so I went for it. They accepted me. I had to fundraise like $5,000 or $6,000. At that point, I had $90,000 of student loan debt. No normal logical person would be like, yeah, that's a good idea. Why don't you fundraise and spend a year focusing on that? And it was the best thing I ever did for my mental health, for my faith, to step out, to take this risk, to do something that I wanted to do and not listen to that part of my brain that said, no, just stay safe, stay in your community, just keep going to church every day. I do think we miss a little bit of that, going out and helping people who need us, you know, getting ourselves in places where marginalized people are. That's what Jesus called us to do. The verse that has been the central to my whole life is, what you do for the least of these, you do for me. And I hear that in my head from Jesus every single day. It's like, he calls us to go find the people who need us the most. That's why I focus on suicide prevention, is because that's where I feel called to help. But I think our faith starts to get a little bit same, and I think our mental health even sometimes starts to feel a little monotonous if we're not taking some of those bold risks and those courageous steps that I think God calls us to.
I love the term you used, adventure. We live in a very sterile society. There's not really a West to go and conquer. So do you think that there's maybe something to be said about Christians not wanting to step out and go do things that we want to do because it feels selfish?
I don't know about selfish. I think, at least for me, I think perhaps the church, and at least I'm in the suburbs, I'm in, you know, a cushy part of the world. We've made our churches so inviting because we want people to come be a part of what we're doing. But there is an element of faith that should feel uncomfortable, that should feel a little dangerous, a little bit scary from time to time, like that you're putting yourself out there and that you're taking some risks, like, you know, the disciples did. You know, it's not, I think the way that Jesus, when we look at the life Jesus led and the ways that he stood up to power and the ways that he stood up to corruption, we can't do that sitting at home or just sitting in a church building. We do have to go. And for me, I've always connected with God more in nature, when I'm out doing things, when I'm out serving. That is when I feel closest to God. I understand worship and I go to worship and I participate, but something about the way I was designed, I connect best with God. And it took me a long time to accept that and to be that it's okay, that there's 8 billion people on this planet, and maybe our relationship and the way that we connect with God looks different. Maybe it is different for different people. And so I hope people explore that. Yes, like, take the good steps, especially where you are on your life, but don't be afraid to take a risk. Don't be afraid to go do something and have an adventure with God and see where it takes you, because some of the best days of my entire life have been because I did that, because I said yes to something and going somewhere I never would have.
I really appreciate the idea of stepping out in faith, doing things that are dangerous. And yet, A, I guess it's comforting knowing we have a God who provides for if he's calling us out into, you know, like Peter stepping out on, walking on water, like, oh my, it's not substantial. And you have to rely on him for our strength. To that point, I wonder if, especially in American culture, we're kind of sold an idea like this is a productive life, you know, go live in an office or go work a job that makes money. And that's really the end of our life. But from what you're describing, it sounds like, you know, it's more than that. God can call us to go do dangerous things, you know, lean on him. How can we, I guess, as Christians, connect with our hearts to find what God might be calling us to do? It seems like maybe our desires can be a prompting of God to go do this thing. How do we connect with our hearts, I guess? It's a big question.
I think sometimes we put too big of a emphasis on this purpose. Like our life needs some big divine purpose. Like God's going to tell you, start a nonprofit. And sometimes it is that. Sometimes it literally is just being the light in your day-to-day life. It is going to your job and thinking of other people, giving them little gifts, encouraging them, like telling them what a nice smile they have. Just being a kind light in the world is living out a purpose. Absolutely, 100%. Nobody needs to travel to Africa to do that. And I think the best place to start to give back is to look back at your own story and reach back into your story in places that you were struggling, whether that was maybe you really struggled in college or high school, or maybe you struggled as a single mom and now you can help single moms. But I think oftentimes the place where we can have the biggest impact is places where we know the struggle and we know what that hurt feels like. And we are uniquely, you know, God says he can use all things for good. I don't believe he causes bad things in our life so that we can use them. I believe we have free will. But I also believe that those words, that we can use the hard things in our life for good. And it actually helps me. My second book is called Healing Out Loud. I write about it. Actually is very healing to me to give back. When I travel to high schools and talk to kids, or when I travel to churches around the country and I get to hug this teenager who's just crying in my shoulder and saying, this is the first time anyone ever described what it's like, feels like to be me, and that I'm going to be okay, that, you know, 10, 15 years down the road, that there's a different life waiting for me. That is when I feel the most connected to God and when I feel like, oh, this, I'm doing good work in the world. And I think that's available to everybody. Whatever you've been through, start there. Think through where can you go back in your story and use that to help somebody.
Which of these affirmations that you've been writing about have been particularly helpful for you? And I guess, what would you want your readers coming away from? How do you want them to be reformed, shaped, molded?
One of the biggest moments for me was I was standing in front of the mirror. I was about 30, and I kind of had this big breakthrough where I was like, I cannot spend the next 40 years hating myself. Like, I am my own worst enemy so often, and I cannot keep operating this way. So I hope if anybody is reading or listening to the book and they can identify with that, they can hear the ways that those voices are holding them back or not encouraging the best that they can, that they'll take a moment and not just go on autopilot and not just accept that this is the life that I have to live, and instead find the phrase that works for them. That's why I wrote so many different of them. I actually hated affirmations. In fact, I think they sound stupid sometimes. I'm like, when a therapist told me to try it, I was like, this is dumb. But the research actually does show that finding those phrases that work for you, and this is the entire mental health journey, is just staying curious and staying open. I hear so many people say, oh, I'll never go to therapy, I'll never try this. And my hope is that we can learn to just be more open and wonder, you know, I am afraid to try therapy, but I'm going to stay curious that maybe there's something here that can help me. Same with the affirmations. It's, you know, maybe these sound dumb as you read and you say them out loud, but maybe there's something in there that just you can hold on to, and you can find a couple that work for you that you can say every day, whether that's you can do this. That's something I have to keep telling myself. And that's ultimately what I hope, is that it encourages and empowers people to find a life that feels fully and recklessly alive to them. And maybe that is being a mom. Maybe that's your whole life dream and you just want to be the best mom ever. And I love that. And moms struggle too. You know, moms also need someone that says you can do this when they're on diaper change number 47. And so I just think there are all moments where we need a friend. We need a little whisper in our ear that says, hey, I know life gets hard sometimes. I know you feel stuck, but you can get through this. God has beautiful plans ahead for you. And I can't wait to see what those look like.
You've been listening to His People on Pilgrim Radio. Many thanks to our guest, Sam Eden, author of Recklessly Alive, What My Suicide Attempt Taught Me About God and Living Life to the Fullest. Coming up on tomorrow's program, it's J.P. DeGantz on supporting healthy marriages for stronger faith.
There's a lot of evidence, first off, from the data that couples that pray together stay together, and they are happier. So in that 10-minute check-in, starting with appreciation and then asking our spouse, what can I pray for you? You know, closing that time, 10 minutes together, that you invite to prayer together. I think it's a great habit for us to develop a prayer life. I think it's important for us to have a life of prayer individually on our own. It's important for us to have a prayer life as a family, okay, when we have children, but it's also actually super important for us to develop a prayer life together.
That's tomorrow at the same time, right here on His People. Thanks for listening.